All right, I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 14th, 2023. We do have a quorum present. First item on the agenda is the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Finke moves the minutes of March 9th, 2023. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, not seeing any. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved, and I'm going to pass the gavel.
Chair Breaker Finn, would you like to move to recommended House File 922 be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Would you like to address? I see we have an A1 amendment. Would you like to address your amendment?
Yep, I would move the A1 amendment. It's just changing the word must to the word may, so making something.
Any discussion to the amendment? I didn't think so. Seeing no further discussion to the amendment, Chair Breaker Finn renews the motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead, Chair Breaker Finn. Your bill isn't before the committee.
All right. Thank you, Chair Frazier. So if folks remember, 2 years ago we passed a bill to provide counsel to parents who are facing termination of their parental rights in child protection proceedings. This bill is kind of phase two of that effort. So that bill that we passed 2 years ago has now come into effect, and parents now do have that right to counsel in their child protection hearings. And this bill would set up a statewide office of appellate counsel for parents so that if they're in a situation where they need to appeal the decision that was made at the district court level, they would have the assistance and support to do so. Obviously, facing the loss of your parental rights is a really big deal, and we want to make sure that parents are fully supported and have the legal counsel that they need to make their case before the court. So I could get it, you know, we can get further into the details, but I do have some testifiers and want to make sure that we have time to hear from them. But that's the short version of the bill. I will also, before the question is asked, we're sending it to State Gov. They will send it back to us. The idea with sending it to State Gov is because we're setting up this separate office that's separate from the courts and directing the Department of Administration to help them run that office that requires a stop in state government. So,
thank you. And I see you have two testifiers. Would Brooke Baskow-Warg please come up? Please introduce yourself and say your name correctly if I jacked it up.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Brooke Baskow-Warg. I'm an attorney with Hennepin County Adult Representation Services, and I've represented parents on appeal at both the Minnesota Court of Appeals and at the Minnesota Supreme Court. Thank you all for considering this important bill. As you're probably aware, Minnesota's child protection system is plagued by disparities. Data from the Minnesota Department of Human Services shows that American Indian, Black, Hispanic, and children of two or more races are more likely to enter foster care and have their parents' rights terminated, and they're less likely than their white peers to be adopted. Additionally, most families who enter the system are living in poverty. Minnesota's appellate courts provide important oversight in termination of parental rights cases, which are considered to be the civil equivalent of the criminal death penalty, as they can result in the permanent severance of the parent and child relationship. Appellate courts ensure proper and fair application of laws and are courts with the power to remedy errors that may have resulted in an improper termination of parental rights. Appellate courts also provide vital future guidance for district courts and for attorneys practicing in this area to ensure that due process rights of all those involved in the proceedings are protected, and that needless errors that harm Minnesota's families can be prevented in the future. Appeals and having an effective appellate system are effective tools for reducing disparities in Minnesota's child protection system. As Chair Becker-Finn noted, parents now have a statutory right to counsel on appeal. They also have a statutory right to appeal a final order in their case, including a termination of parental rights order. But the current lack of a central resource for appointing appellate attorneys means that some parents never have their right to an appeal vindicated. And this, of course, negatively impacts individual rights. It also affects the integrity of the entire system. Given the state's struggle with racial disparities, these negative impacts are too often felt more strongly by our communities of color and families living in poverty. It's for these reasons that Minnesota must establish an Office of Appellate Counsel and Training. This bill represents a critical step forward in improving outcomes for children and families involved in child protection proceedings in Minnesota. Thank you again for considering this bill and for your dedication to reducing disparities and ensuring due process for all individuals in child protection matters in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Warwick. Now I have Ann Carlson. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Ann Morris Carlson, and I am owner of Ann Morris Carlson, or Ann M. Carlson Law Office. I have brought 39 appeals of child protection matters in the state of Minnesota. As recently as December 27th of 2022, I had to voluntarily dismiss an appeal based on lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The reason for that is that after a 20-day window has closed, appeals need to be dismissed because the Court of Appeals is not able to review them. And this has happened to me on three different occasions of appeals that I've been appointed. The way that I get appointed to appeals is that court administration will reach out to me in various counties. I've been appointed in 10 different counties, I believe, in the state of Minnesota. And there's a disconnect between the trial attorney and the appellate attorney, where the trial attorney often does not want to take the next step of the appeal, and then court administration is tasked with finding an appellate attorney who is willing to finish the process for parents of ensuring that their needs, that ensuring that they get that right to review. I'm in support of this bill based on the fact that I do believe that there are struggles with parents having due process under the law and equal protection under the law when appeals have to be dismissed based on the fact that there isn't a centralized process of identifying attorneys that are able to carry their cases to the final steps.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson.
Thank you.
Are there any public members that would like to testify to this bill? Seeing none, I will open it up to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker-Finn. I appreciate where this bill is coming from. Definitely, this is an important place to have that due process is very important, and that includes rights to appeal when there's a meritorious appeal. I have a few questions about sort of the nuts and bolts of this, and I wanted to start with the path that this bill is on and sort of where this office is situated. My understanding is this is going to be a judicial branch office. Is that right?
Yes, but it won't be overseen by the court. Sorry. It won't be overseen by the courts. The idea is that it would be a separate entity so that the courts wouldn't have a say, because obviously the attorney would need to be separate, and you wouldn't want the courts to have any say in how they represent their clients.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, Representative Becker-Finn, and that was my understanding as well. And so I just wanted we don't have a fiscal note, we don't have an amount that this is going to cost. I'm guessing that means there will be a fiscal note at some point before it comes back to this committee. Is that the expectation?
Chair Becker-Finn.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's why I explained at the beginning that it's coming back to us. But we did want to make sure that we got this testimony in before deadline and that folks knew that this was coming. And part of it is changing the must to may changes some things with the fiscal note. But obviously, we have to know how much it costs before we can include it in an omnibus bill.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker-Finn. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure everyone kind of was on the same page about that. What is the best information we have about how many meritorious appeals? I just mean non-frivolous appeals, not necessarily that they're appeals that are going to win, but how many meritorious appeals are being missed right now because of, you know, the 20-day jurisdictional deadline and cases falling between the gaps of lack of, you know, good appellate lawyers to be able to just issue spot and tell whether there's a good appeal. Do we have any good data about that?
Chair Becker-Finn.
You know, unfortunately, we don't. You know, this is a new, that having the right, if you qualify financially to have an attorney, this is a brand new thing, so there really isn't the data. I mean, part of the point of setting up this office is that then this office would have an idea because they would be getting those referrals and getting those asks, and they'd have a better idea. I think the problem right now is that if you cannot afford counsel for yourself, you probably don't, there are parents right now probably don't even realize that the clock is ticking. So I think it'd be really hard to know because they haven't been vetted by attorneys, which is the whole point of the bill before us.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I appreciate, like I said, I appreciate the direction that this bill is going, and we'll see if we can figure out some of those things when it comes back here. So thanks.
Any further discussion? Seeing none. Chair Becker-Finn, please close.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank our testifiers and the work of the folks, some attorneys and other folks from Mitchell-Hamlin who have really been leading the charge on this issue. Obviously, this is not a partisan issue. Whether you have access to wealth or not should not impact whether you have access to justice, and this is just another bill that points us in that direction. Appreciate members' support.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Becker-Finn renews the motion to recommend that House File 922, as amended, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails.
We're going to trade spots. Next up is House File 855, Vice Chair Frazier bill. Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move that your bill, House File 855, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Just to remind folks, this entire bill is not under discussion today. We'll be focusing on Article 2, Section 1 regarding body camera data, and then Article 3, Section 4 around civilian oversight data classification. So with that, I will turn it over to Vice Chair Frazier to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you noted, the two items that we're focusing on, one, we will be providing resources so that all local law enforcement departments will be able to provide body cameras to their officers. As part of that, we're also providing policy that when those officers are engaged in police activities, they keep those cameras on. That is to provide for the transparency which protects the officer and also provides transparency to help build trust with that, build and create that trust relationship with the communities that they serve. There are some pieces that we're still working out on the body camera piece. One is the storage piece that is required by law. We're working with law enforcement to figure out that piece. Right now in the bill, we have this kind of overall cloud storage piece that we are made aware may not be feasible and may not work. And what it's looking like we will have to do is provide that each local entity have the ability to provide storage on their own. But we're working that piece out. And so we may be coming back, but we're working that piece out as we get through the process. And we've been having these talks for a while now, so we're hoping we'll get there. The other focus is on, again, back to the transparency. We have language, and we've worked on this with the BCA, who conducts many of the investigations, the use of force investigations or investigations where there is a death that occurs from engagement with a police officer. We're working on a time certain and when that data will be available. 5 days for family members or family representatives, and 14 days for public. With the caveat that if there's anything that would interfere with the investigation that is going, we don't want that to happen, that the video will be able to be withheld, but there will be an appeals process that allow the family members or public to challenge that if they believe it is not the case that is would interfere with an investigation. The other piece that is up for discussion here is the civilian review boards. What it does is give power back to local entities to provide more authority to civilian review boards, if they choose so, to provide investigations to look into misconduct allegations for law enforcement. Doesn't require them to do it, but it gives them the ability to provide more authority for those civilian review boards and also for the leaders in the local law enforcement to work with those civilian review boards to conduct those investigations and work with that transparency and accountability piece. Those are the pieces before us. I will. I believe there's a couple of testifiers here, so I'll yield to those testifiers, and then I'll be ready for discussion.
Sounds good. We do have a couple members of the public signed up to testify. First up, I have Matt Gearing from Minkoji.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, members. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'll be very brief. Our organization supports the standardized 14-day time frame for the public release of footage documenting lethal force action. Having a common procedure and reference point in statute, we think will help to facilitate the timely release of such footage, and we thank Representative Frazier for bringing this forward. We have also submitted comments both in your packets and to Representative Frazier regarding some technical changes we'd like to suggest in order to clarify the function not only of the public release portion, but the entire new section that's added between lines 5.1 and 5.20. I know that the similar language is laid over in the Senate, and it sounds like there's time to work on it here, so we'd be happy to answer any questions on our suggestions or to answer any questions on the body camera section in general. We worked on that back in 2015, 2016.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I know you'll stick around if there are questions. Next on the list, I have Michelle Gross. All right. Any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frazier, I'm just wondering, and I know this is still a work in progress. I was just trying to find the section of the bill that I was going to ask the question about, and I'm sure it's in Article 2 somewhere, but it was alluded to that, let me just reframe the question. Have there been cases that you know of where law enforcement has tampered with the video footage that on these sorts of cases?
Representative Frazier.
I can't speak to a specific case off the top of mind, but the idea is to just ensure that with the language there, it gives the assurance that there is transparency when this data will be provided to the public.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I'm wondering, and maybe this is a question for House Research, is there a penalty if law enforcement would tamper with and somehow skew or redact, wrongfully redact, either exculpatory. Is there a penalty for them tampering with the video on body cam?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I think it depends exactly what we mean by tamper with. There's the ability for a law enforcement agency to redact certain identities from a video, and that's permissible under the body camera statute. There's an ability to maybe edit out portions of a video if they're offensive to common sensibilities. You can see that on page 5, lines 21 through 23. So there is ability that's recognized in law for the law enforcement agency to redact certain things or edit certain things from a video. Now, if there was some kind of like tampering in the sense of like obfuscating the video or editing things over, I don't think that there would be necessarily the penalties in Chapter 13 that would apply to that. I mean, a data subject can always challenge the accuracy and completeness about data that a law enforcement entity maintains about themselves. So if you were the subject of this body camera footage and it had been altered somehow, you could bring an action in court to verify the authenticity of the information.
Representative Scott.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins, and thank you, Madam Chair. So wouldn't that be obstruction of justice, basically?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson from House Research. The facts are going to matter in terms of how I answer that question, but in broad terms, yes, if there is some sort of willful and intentional tampering of evidence, that is likely to be a crime, perhaps obstruction of justice. Again, it's going to depend exactly on what the details are. It's also likely that any prosecution that involves evidence that's attempted to be submitted, where there's evidence that that evidence was tampered with or falsified in some way, such a prosecution is very likely to be dismissed. Again, these things are going to turn on the specific facts of the case.
Representative Scott.
Thank you for that, Mr. Johnson and Madam Chair. So back in the day when we were working on this law for body cameras, back then I didn't get everything I want, but I feel like, you know, I don't think everybody in the room was 100% happy, which they say is probably a sign of a good bill. But one of the things that we settled on was that when there was a case like this that we're referring to in this bill, where there's death or great bodily harm, that if the law enforcement agency believed that it would quell public, it would quell rumors or it would quell public uprising, whatever you might want to call it, that law enforcement could release the body camera or dash cam, whatever it is, footage. And I feel like we're kind of going backwards from that. And I'm just wondering if the bill's author could kind of articulate on why that language as it sits now wasn't adequate.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for that question. Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen over the last few years there's been situations where body camera footage has been requested, and in some cases it's taken well over a year before that footage has been released. And when we see that, and the guise has always been that there was some reason, maybe investigative or other purposes or reasons, that it was being withheld. And once the video is released, those things didn't really kind of pan out. But what we do know is what it did do is it created greater distrust between the community and law enforcement when the data wasn't released in the fashion and in the time that it was requested. Simply what we're trying to do here is make sure there's a time certain. And again, based on the conversations I've had and based on the cases that we've seen in the last few years where that data wasn't released and what I would deem to be a timely fashion after requested, I think this would create better transparency and lead to better relationships in doing so.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frazier, those things are important, but it's also important for somebody to get a fair trial if there's going to be. And my concern with releasing it like this is that that it could obstruct in some way or compromise an investigation. You know, we want to have a jury, if it goes to a jury trial, we want to make sure that the jury pool is untainted. And I just feel like this isn't allowing enough discretion to prevent that from happening. And I so I have concerns with that. But I'll end my questioning there. I think some other members of our side have some questions. Thank you.
All right. Any comment, Vice Chair?
Yeah, just to that comment. I mean, again, this was in conjunction with BCA, which is law enforcement. They do a majority of all these investigations. And the timeline was based on when they believed they could have the investigations done to where they believed it wouldn't have an impact on that investigation. So I'm comfortable with that because law enforcement says they're comfortable with that timeline, which is provided in coordination with drafting language.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Frazier. I understand what you're looking at doing here, but I'm on Section 3, Subdivision 1C. Usually when there's a...
And Representative Johnson, if you could point us to the line, give us a better idea so we can all look...
7.2.
Thank you.
Or 7.20.
Thank you.
Rules governing certain misconduct. And this is requiring the post board to investigate misconduct. Now, I'm not sure if you know the process right now for any allegations of misconduct by a peace officer. It goes to the chief or whatever, or
administrator. Representative Johnson, this actually isn't before us in the Judiciary Committee. This is the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee. That's why I was trying to figure out exactly where you're pointing to. If it's Article 3, Section 4, we're just dealing with data today.
Okay.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
I will go to back to another area dealing with the body camera footage. I have no problem letting the family see it, because I think that's important. But I don't know if anybody's been following the news lately. There's been a lot of release of video from January 6th that shows a whole new light on what happened there, where secured police officers and security were actually escorting people around the building. That was never released before. And so we have some people that have been charged with trespassing and everything else, and they've already been convicted while they were, and it turns out the video shows they're actually being escorted around showing the building. Because the news did only little snippets was released, and the news only used certain parts of it, and that's what people saw. So I'm concerned with just actually releasing within 14 days that be more misinformation, and not the total information is going to be available for the public to see, and it could taint the jury badly on not giving a person a fair trial. Also, 14 days, if there's a major event, the video might not ever be redacted in that time. For every, I believe it's 1 minute or... I'm trying to remember correctly. It's been a while since I've heard these numbers. But I think it's for every minute of video, it can take a couple hours to redact it. Now, if you have 14 officers at a scene and the scene lasts about 45 minutes, there's no way all that video could be redacted, because you not only have the body cameras, you have the squad cameras. So you're looking at hours and hours and hours of redacting. I think it should be left up to the department and the prosecutor if video should be released and when. It is going to be released to the defense as well, when at the proper timing, if it ends up going to charges. But I think the police chief works with the prosecutors right now to decide if it's the best interest to release the video or not. And I think that has been worked well over the years. But there again, I have no problem giving time to release the video and showing the video to the victim's family. But so, like I say, I have concerns on it, because the investigative part is so important to make sure we get it right and that those charged also get a fair trial.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, there is language in there that says if there's belief that it will interfere with the investigation, they can hold the video. So that piece is covered. And I agree with you. We don't want any interference with the investigation. We want people to have a fair due process. And you made the comment about the Fox News video that's recently been released. And I can tell you, I know that there's been a comment from federal prosecutors that said that's not the whole video. where's the video prior to that point that they showed, and where's the video after that point that they showed. And I think when we talk about video being released to tell a certain story, that does happen. And it shouldn't happen, because it inflames the community, inflames the crowd, and it paints a false narrative that actually doesn't exist. So I agree with you on that, and I think that when you're trying to tell a story, you should provide the entire context, and we're trying to achieve that with this language.
Yeah, a good reminder, we can't control what's on Fox News. Representative Finke.
You can't. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for the bill. And to the mutterings, I would say we can't control what's on any news station. And that's why we need to have footage released. We need to have. I just want to come and give the alternative.
Members?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to whisper and mutter to each other while other members are talking. You had the courtesy of our members being quiet while you were talking, and the same is going to be true. Representative Finke, you have the floor.
Thank you, and I appreciate what Representative Johnson is saying when we don't get to see the whole picture. And I think 14 days is far too long. I think it should be on the onus of the prosecutor to tell us why it shouldn't be released in 48 hours. I think we can look at very recent, very local reasons why we don't release police footage. And often it's because we are getting initial reports that are untrue. We got untrue reports from the police about what happened to George Floyd, and then we didn't get to see it. We got untrue reports about what happened to Breonna Taylor and what happened to Philando Castile, and then we don't get to see the footage, and we have to, for the sake of a fair trial, only have false information in the public. It's absolutely disgraceful. I think we should say all footage should be released within 48 hours unless there's a good reason, because the only testimony can't be false police reports. And that's what we are seeing. And to the point of this, the idea that we need to wait until it's deemed appropriate, we should give it to the people. Give all the January 6th footage, and then we won't have Tucker Carlson's edit and MSNBC's edit. People can watch it. I worked for the ACLU. I watched way more footage of this than anybody probably should ever do. But that was my job, and I went into the footage, and I watched the footage that was being released, and I understood what was happening. People aren't incapable of watching video and understanding it. So I just want to come at this from the journalism side, from the side of people who are trying to get access to truth. And the access to truth doesn't come from holding a video secret. It comes from releasing it to everybody and letting people know what really happened. So thank you for this bill. I support it. I would love to see that shortened.
Thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frazier, my question is about the Civilian Oversight Councils that this bill would be empowering. And in particular, are there any other professions where we have citizen boards empowered to retain investigators, subpoena and compel testimony, et cetera? Or is this kind of a new structure we're creating just for the law enforcement profession?
Vice Chair Frazier.
Arab Vaniska, we actually had it here in the state of Minnesota, so we would actually be given the power back that we took away a few years ago.
Representative Niska.
Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Vice Chair Frazier.
Again, we're trying to get to a point where we're building trust and we're building relationships with transparency and accountability. And I think the language in this bill helps do that. Representative Finke, thank you for your comments. And what this language doesn't do is prevent prosecutors and law enforcement and local governments from releasing the video as soon as possible. It doesn't prevent them from doing that. We've seen in some cases where they've done that, and it's been very helpful to quell any type of misconstrued things that have been put out there in the community. And I think it's gone a long way to stop potential civil unrest from happening. But we've also seen situations where it hasn't. This gives a time certain so folks can anticipate when the video will be released. And I agree. I think that the moment you have it, you look at the video and you can put it out there to quell anything, you should do that. And like I said before, we have seen that in some cases, but not in all cases. And we want to make sure there's at least some baseline forward, and I think this goes in that direction, and we can keep working toward doing better. I think that's always the joy of doing this job. We can always continue to work toward doing things better. So I urge your support, members.
All right. Vice Chair Frazier renews the motion to recommend that House Bill 855 be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Frazier. All right, Representative Herr. I will move House File 1234 before the committee, and the motion would be that we re-refer to the state. I hope State Gov has some meeting times blocked out. Be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Just a reminder to members, the provisions that brought this bill to our committee are Section 5, Subdivision 8, and Section 7, Subdivision 8, again, regarding data. With that, Representative Herr, the bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and committee, for hearing House File 1234. This is a bill that has been in the works for over 2 years and has been through 15 revisions. A working group that negotiated the terms of this bill included members from 15 entities representing cities, chiefs, labor, pension, law enforcement, and firefighters. The bill had its first hearing of public safety last week, and today, as Chair Beckerfin indicated, it is in front of judiciary because of Subdivision 8 in both the sections under PAIR and MSRS, which are the pension plans that administer pensions for our police and fire. These sections have a treatment data provision limiting this data and how it can be disclosed or shared, and you can find this on my copy on page 9 and page 23. I hope it's the same for you. Chair Beckerfin, I can do a quick walkthrough of the bill if the committee would like to know overall what this bill stands for to give them context.
Just a brief walkthrough would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. This bill establishes treatment for a psychological condition before a peace officer or firefighter can apply for duty disability benefits under existing law. Section 7 and Section 15 contain the substance of the bill requiring up to 24 weeks of psychological condition treatment. These sections are identical. Parallel provisions with Section 7 applying to members of the State Patrol Retirement Plan under MSRS and Section 15 applying to members of the Police and Fire Plan under PARA. The specifics of the application and treatment process are laid out in these sections. The psychological condition treatment would be at the direction of the mental health provider who would report on the employee's progress and prognosis. A current employee would receive full salary and benefits during treatment, and treatment costs would be paid for by the employer. The employer would then seek reimbursement for those costs. At the end of 24 weeks, one of three determinations would be made. One, the employee would be able to be approved to continue treatment for 8 additional weeks. Two, the employee would end treatment because it is determined the employee is able to return to work full-time in the position they held at the time of injury or equivalent position. Or three, the provider would confirm that the employee successfully completed treatment at which the employee could apply for disability or duty disability benefits under existing law. The remainder of the bill makes conforming changes to existing law to reflect new treatment and eligibility requirements. It also makes several technical pension changes to duty disability benefits and administration under PARA statutes. The bill also appropriates money to MSRS and PARA for administration, the new process for technical reimbursement of employees. Finally, the bill also appropriates money to fund continued health insurance for disabled peace officers and firefighters. This is an existing statutory requirement. In addition, it adds pre-service and in-service wellness training requirements. State and local law enforcement agencies would be required to maintain records of compliance with these training requirements, and the wellness training would be a prerequisite to reimbursement for the continued health insurance. This concludes the summary, Madam Chair, and I do have testifiers here today if you would like to go ahead with that before questions.
Sure, we will go ahead with that. Sorry, I have too many notes.
I do have Chris Parson. I think on the original we had Scott Badness on the list. So if we, and I have Chris Parson next to me. He's the prior president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And with your permission, I can have him go ahead and testify.
Yep. Mr. Parsons, please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairperson Beckerfin and members of the committee. I'm Chris Parsons, former president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I'm testifying in place of current President Scott Badness, who is attending to a family emergency. The MPFF represents over 2,000 firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, and emergency dispatchers who protect cities large and small all across Minnesota. Part of our mission is to advocate for the betterment of the fire and EMS service in our state and for the protection of its most important resource, which is the men and women who respond at a moment's notice to protect lives and property. That's why I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 1234. In 2018, as then president of the MPFF, I had the pleasure of working with fire and EMS and other public safety leaders from across the state on a bill to help public safety officers who suffer mental injuries as a result of their employment. From the beginning, our top priority was to ensure that the people we asked to put themselves in harm's way would get the care they needed when the stress of the job became too much. This was a concept that had broad bipartisan support with chief authors from both parties. A bill was passed, but unfortunately the result is our current system that provides zero pathway back to work for public safety officers who seek treatment for mental injuries. Workers who file a claim are invariably denied treatment and must use their own sick leave in order to get the treatment they deserve. What that means for our members is that when their sick leave runs out, they are faced with having to file for duty disability through PERA in order to pay their bills and put food on their family's table. We need a way that gets firefighters and EMS workers and others who work in public safety who are struggling with the effects of mental injuries the help they need fast and give them the time they need to get healthy while ensuring they will not need to worry about financial losses or losing their career. House File 1234 will do that. It provides for up to 32 weeks of employer-paid mental health treatment for public safety workers who need it, and for those who cannot return to the job after treatment, a duty disability. This bill helps local governments pay for health insurance coverage for those who cannot return to work, which is a significant financial burden, especially on smaller cities. This bill provides an incentive for employers to provide first responders with health and wellness training and resources so that they have the tools to better cope with the daily stresses of their essential work. House File 1234 will also help protect our PERA, Police and Fire Retirement Plan, which allows thousands of our current active and retired members to retire with dignity after a decades-long career of protecting the public. The bill before you today is the product of many years of hard work and represents the input of fire, EMS, and other public safety stakeholders. I implore you to please show your support for the men and women who every day put themselves in danger so that we may all be safer. I ask for you to vote yes on House File 1234. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Chief John Swenson. And then I've got Ann Finn on deck, if you can be ready. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. John Swenson. I'm the Public Safety Director for the City of Lionel Lakes, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association today. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1234 on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I would like to thank Representative Herr and Representative Long for their work on this vitally important legislation. I've had the honor and privilege of serving as a police officer for 30 years in the communities of Minneapolis, White Bear Lake, and Lionel Lakes. And I have seen the toll that this profession can have on police officers and firefighters. I know that this legislation will help police officers and firefighters stay healthy and continue to serve in our honorable profession. We have worked very hard with all of the stakeholders over the last 2 years to address mental health injuries of our first responders. Through this work, we learned from mental health experts that mental health injuries are highly treatable, particularly post-traumatic stress disorder. We provide treatment to our first responders who sustain physical injuries. We have to provide treatment to our first responders who sustain mental health injuries. This legislation will do just that. Treatment for our first responders is at the very core of this legislation, and it is important to remove barriers for those seeking treatment. Ensuring that treatment data is classified as private data is an important element in getting our first responders the treatment they need and deserve. We ask the members of this committee to support this legislation. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Ann Finn. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. The League is a statewide association representing 838 of Minnesota's 855 cities. We just got a new city, so I have to remember the new number. Madam Chair and members, we strongly support this legislation, and just to the provision that's before the committee, I wanted to let you know that that's something that came from the Law Enforcement Labor Services during the negotiations on this bill, and the employers are agreeable to that provision. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for sticking to the provisions in front of us. And I didn't misspeak earlier. So the provisions in front of us are 9.24 to 9.29 and then lines 23.31 to 24.2. So thank you for testifying to that piece. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we will move on to member discussion. Again, reminding us really the question is whether treatment data should be private for the purposes of the bill is what's before us right now. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill forward and for working with all the stakeholders in putting together something that is going to be very helpful to our law enforcement, our firefighters, all of our emergency personnel, frontline folks. I can only give you a small example of the need for this. My 30th day as a police officer, I was shot in the line of duty. Okay. Didn't think that day was going to start out that way, but it did. 5:20 in the morning, disgruntled customer in a hotel. That's what the call was. Me and a fellow officer showed up at the call, and we both knew the gentleman. And so approached him and said, hey, what's going on? Next thing I know, I've got a 38 revolver 6 inches from my face. I grabbed the weapon. First round went past my ear. I've got tinnitus in this ear to this day, reminding me. Tried to get the gun out of his hand, shot me through the arm, and continued to try to get the gun loose to shoot somebody else. I stuffed the gun on the couch. The guy fired one more round. And telling him, giving him verbal commands, stop, you know. And my partner finally stopped the situation. One round killed the gentleman. And I got showered with his blood from head to toe and a mouthful of his blood. There's not a day that goes by with the chronic pain in this arm that I don't think about that morning. That I don't pray for that gentleman's soul, you know, that I don't forgive. Because it's, you know, I don't know what was going on. To this day, I don't know what was going on. But decided that morning it was going to kill somebody. And I happened to be the poor son of a gun that that stepped in there, but I'm glad it was me and not somebody else. So the importance of getting this treatment available to our folks on the front lines, it wasn't there after that happened to me, and that was in 2001, and that's been how many years, you know. So to relive that every day, every time I have a shooting pain in the side of my neck or my arm, it's tough. But you keep moving forward. You keep hoping that it won't happen to somebody else. You keep trying to do your job to make sure that, you know, you stop these things. So to have this kind of help out there for our folks who are putting their lives out there in the wind to help everybody else, you know, I think it's a good thing. It might not be perfect, but I know you're willing to work with all the stakeholders to try to fine-tune it and make it even better if possible. So thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Herr, thank you again for working on this issue. Back when this first became a law as an amendment on the floor of the House, I knew there was going to be some problems that we need to do a lot of work on it. And I want to commend you for taking this challenge. It's a huge challenge. Like Representative Grossel, I have skeletons that come to see me as well. I've actually been there when we had to unfortunately take somebody out. was shooting at numerous officers at the time, and we spent hours trying to settle that before he took a shot in the direction of myself and another officer, and the other officer had to take him out. I've also had the issue where I have my friend Timmy, who comes to sits on my shoulder fairly regularly to come to talk to me and give me some advice. Now, Timmy was a two-year-old drowning victim that I had to do CPR on. Well, law enforcement officers see a lot. They can't go home and talk about it. They used to have what's called choir practice, where they'd go talk to their friends after work, deal with the situation. That's not allowed anymore. They used to get together at the coffee shop on their break and talk to each other. And that was when you went to stress relief classes. That's what you were told to do. But administrations, because the public won't, gets mad because there's too many cops sitting talking to each other, they can't do that anymore. We used to have a lot of ways to deal with the stress and the PTSD that we can't do anymore. So unfortunately, we have to have a bill like this. Well, you said you worked with a lot of the stakeholders. I just want to make sure that you worked with MPPOA, represented the officers, because I've had a number of phone calls concerning this bill from officers. So they do still have some concerns with the yearly, I believe it's yearly, they have to go back in after they've been approved. I know that's not part of the bill, but I would like that for a part of this committee, but I would like to make sure that the question I've been getting, those that have already been approved, are they going to have to go back yearly now for this evaluation, even though they've already been approved and on the program?
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, and thank you for the question. So currently right now, there already is a yearly reapplication process. It is just that we're codifying that into law. We have, MPPOA was at the table with us during negotiations. They did write, Brian Peters did write a letter of support in public safety. And to be honest, you are correct that this is a really big bill, and it has a lot that we're trying to do. And no one in any of those groups got everything that they wanted. And they will... But what I did get was a commitment from the entire group to say that if this bill doesn't work the way we hope that it should, that we would all come back together to say what else needs to happen. So know that I am committed to that, and we'll continue to work through that. Thank you.
Representative Weens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr. Much has been said. The only thing I really want to say is there's so much more we're learning about mental health and things that we did not in a previous generation, and we're learning now. And I applaud the efforts. I know it's not perfect. Many first responders do neck up checks. Those of us that are in the service or have been in the service have seen things and witnessed things that were an issue, and we had to get through we had to destigmatize this whole thing. And I think groups like NAMI and legislators that have a willingness to step into that gray zone to get good things done for people. Again, it's not perfect. I would like to see what the cost is so we can appropriately approach this and we don't overburden what we promise, that we make it right by the taxpayers and also those that we intend to serve. I am always mystified that we sometimes overpromise and underdeliver. But I want to say that I intend to support this, thank you. I applaud you for this. Thank you.
Thank you, and I know there's some strong feelings about this bill, but the only reason it's here is not the fiscal note or any other piece, but whether that data, that health record data, should be private or not. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair and Representative Herr, good job on the data language. that's why we're here. And the reason I say that in particular is it's really thorough and button tight. And I think there's always that fear in these first responders if they come forward with an issue that is mental health related, that it won't be a secret, right? It won't be held in confidence. And so I'm hoping that language will help
tear down that barrier so that people will get the help that they need. Thank you.
It's almost like Representative Herr served on the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and Representative Scott. And I was channeling my inner Representative Scott when this was going to come to this committee. And I did also ask both the employers, so the cities, the municipalities, and also PAIR to say, what are the systems you are using? How are we protecting that data? Who is holding the data? And so even though the language states are very clear what we need to do, I always want to make sure that the data is protected at the people who are administering it as well. So thank you, Representative Scott. You've trained me well in ensuring data is good.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you again, Representative Herr, for this bill. This is the second time now that I've gotten to hear it, and I really appreciate you bringing it forward. And I can speak to the data piece. I will say it's unfortunate the number of folks in this committee who've dealt firsthand with PTSD. It's no secret that I have as well. And I will say when I went through this, it was as recent as 5 years ago. And this wasn't available to me. I don't have disability. I didn't get anything offered to me. And a big part of that was a misunderstanding, perhaps, or no clarity on if I were to ask for that assistance and that treatment, who had that information? Mm-hmm. And would that information be used against me if I were to try to go for a promotion or try to go, for some other position within law enforcement? And so I really appreciate that the private data is at the forefront of this, because I do think that that's a barrier when people are trying to seek treatment. So I did want to highlight that, and just I really appreciate the attention to the privacy here. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. Representative Herr, closing comments.
Thank you for the discussion today, Chair Beckerfin and committee. This is not a perfect bill, but it is a good bill, and we are trying really hard to ensure that our law enforcement and first responders have what it is that they need in order to be healthy on the job, because when they are well, our community is served well. And so thank you all so much, and I ask for your support of the bill.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 1234 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Herr. Next on the list today, we've got House File 1262. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, I will move to recommend that House File 1262 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. I understand you have an A1 amendment that just aligns the language with the Senate language, so we'll just go ahead and move that. So I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative, welcome to the committee. The bill is now before us in the shape you would like. Please tell us about your bill.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair and members. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to talk about my bill today. This bill, first off, has been worked on for the past 3 years. It's regarding homeowners associations and homeowners who wish to put on solar panels on their roof. This has been done in collaboration with MNSEA as well as the Homeowners Association. It has bipartisan support. And just kind of a brief background, about 1 in 4 Minnesotans live in the state's more than 7,700 homeowners associations, or HOAs. I'm actually in one in Woodbury, too. It's pretty hard to find a neighborhood in Woodbury that does not have an HOA. Many Minnesotans want the opportunity to invest in their homes and lower their energy bills, and installing solar panels is one way to do it. There are 27 other states, including Iowa and Wisconsin, that have laws that limit HOA restrictions on residential solar panels. Indiana and Ohio just passed laws as recently as last year. Under current law, and this is kind of where the frustration comes in, HOAs can ban rooftop solar for any reason. Sometimes they don't even give a reason. They just say no. And so this bill balances those homeowners' rights with the HOA association duties. So there is a process where HOAs still have input and reasonable restrictions. Section 1 goes through a little bit about how homeowners can get monthly data usage, by time of day, and basically that's to help them calculate their demand charge for working with the solar panel company. And then Section 2 adds definitions and states that an HOA cannot refuse to permit the installation of solar panels, basically for no reason. Some of the reasonable requirements in the bill include that the installation has to be done by a licensed contractor. They can't go beyond the roof, so they can't go beyond the peak or hanging off the edge. The installer has to indemnify, or reimburse for damages. The homeowner lists the energy system on their insurance, and the homeowner is responsible for any maintenance or removal. So pretty reasonable expectations. And finally, I will kind of leave with that solar panels do increase the value of the home. So to not give homeowners an opportunity to participate in this way, not really that fair. So I have a couple testifiers and can turn it over to them.
All right. First up, I have Logan O'Grady, and then I have Bobby King on deck. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. I think this is the first time this session I've appeared before this committee, so thank you for having me. Just a quick introduction, MNC is a 501c6 trade organization. We're made up of over 140 member companies who all work within and throughout the Minnesota solar and energy storage industries. Altogether, our 140 members employ over 5,000 Minnesotans within this industry. We really want to thank Representative Hemmingson-Yeager for the work on this. As she mentioned, this has been a couple years of work in collaboration with the HOAs as well as the industry. I think there might be one outstanding issue we're still working through with them, but it's my understanding this bill is going back to energy, so there's time to do that. Our role, as I said, we're an industry-led nonprofit, so our role is really to bring industry perspective to any bill that we support, and so that's what I'm here to do today. Obviously, we work to find barriers to our industry wherever we can find them, and if you're completely prohibited from doing business in a certain community, that's a pretty significant barrier that we're working to overcome. So as Representative Hemmingson-Yeager said, this bill adds a section to Chapter 500 of Minnesota statute, which is limits on real property. It prevents HOAs from completely barring solar while still allowing reasonable restrictions. It allows the HOA still to approve or deny, and it sets a reasonable timeline so that homeowners wanting to do this have an expectation of when it can get done by. So in conclusion, I think just as Minnesotans, we value the idea that people should be able to do whatever they want with their properties, within reason, of course, and this bill takes a step closer to that, and I think it's a bipartisan bill and pretty common sense. So thanks, Madam Chair.
All right. Next up, I have Bobby King. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name's Bobby King. I'm the Minnesota State Director for Solar United Neighbors. We help people go solar through a few different ways. One is through group purchasing to get a better deal on solar for folks, and we use the group purchasing pool to find ways to help low-income homeowners go solar. And we also do education about solar incentives and help people on a one-on-one basis. The Inflation Reduction Act created a lot of strong incentives to go solar, including a 30% tax credit for homeowners and businesses, and increased funding for a program called the Rural Energy for America program, which pays up to 50% of the solar for farmers and rural small businesses. So we're working with quite a few farmers and rural small businesses to take advantage of this opportunity. But we also work on policy to make more solar possible, and that's definitely what this bill does. 30% of homeowners live in an HOA, and I get a couple calls a month from folks that find us on the web saying they wanted to go solar in their HOA and were blocked. And my understanding of how the denial usually happens is HOA rules are often silent on solar, but it's considered an architectural modification, so they have to apply to the committee to get that, and they're quickly denied in the cases that I hear about. And HOA homes are often ideal for solar. Many of them are large, former agricultural areas where there's no trees. And in my experience, HOA homeowners that I deal with are looking at going solar for three reasons. They want to reduce their energy bill. They also want to stabilize it. You know, once you put in solar, you know what your per kilowatt hour price is. And then a lot are a lot of folks are committed to producing renewable energy, but for many folks, it's a real energy savings, and it's an increase in equity in their home. So the concept of the bill is pretty simple, within reason. If you want to go solar on your home and you live in an HOA, you'd be able to. The solar industry is a really mature industry now, and we have lots of great installers in Minnesota. I think some of the anxiety about this, people are imagining solar from the 1970s, and when stuff was propped up at an odd angle on a home. But now panels are, you know, in line with the roof. They're flush, and actually I think they look pretty nice. So we're hoping that you can pass this bill this session. And I know if you do, there's many HOA homeowners waiting to go solar. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill's author, good to see you in our committee this morning. I do have a question, and that is, so if you move into an HOA and you've read those thick bylaws or whatever they call them, the ordinances for their governing documents, and it says that no solar panels are allowed, and then so you move in with that expectation, and then your neighbor gets, they go through this process, and they, you know, solar panels start appearing. Is there any recourse for the person that, you know, moved into an area specifically because they, you know, didn't want that in their community?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Fair question. In my experience with the homeowners that I've talked to, many of these bylaws are very old, and so they don't even mention solar panels. And then what's confusing and kind of frustrating is my husband and I, before we bought our house, we actually requested our realtor get the bylaws ahead of time before we, like, even put in an offer. It was nearly impossible to get those. So I think, you know, especially with everything changing nowadays, like, people are, they're just, the HOAs, I don't think, are ready to address solar panel installation. So I don't think many of them have them in their bylaws.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Well, there's a lot of these new developments. I know in my community we have several new developments going up that are going to be associations like this, homeowners associations. And by the way, the bylaws that they're supposed to get you, I'm a former realtor, and I know by law they have to get those to you within a certain amount of time. So there's already a law to remedy that. If we've had these homeowners associations that are built in the last 5 or 10 years, I'm sure in most cases they've probably addressed, and if it explicitly says in those bylaws that no rooftop solar, again, then this law takes effect and the homeowners association decides differently and allows it. What am I to do if I moved in there exclusively? One of the reasons I moved in was because I wanted to live in a community where there's no rooftop solar.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
So I guess for that particular instance, I would think that, I mean, you could always go back to the HOA and request bylaw changes, specifically if it was already in the bylaws. This is something, though, that I just feel that homeowners should have the choice to do. Not allowing people to take part in, you know, better environmental conditions, tax rebates, leaving them out of that is kind of the inspiration behind this bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my question is, when you move into a homeowners association, you're giving up rights. You know you are. You're going to live by what's set before you. So you walk into that situation knowing that you're giving up certain things that you may or may not want, and that's why you look at those bylaws, is to see if that's some stuff that you can live with. So I'm still not seeing an answer. I mean, would a disgruntled neighbor that didn't want to see solar panels across the street and their homeowners association, would they be able to sue the HOA? Because they felt like, you know, it was kind of a bait and switch, or? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Mr. King, did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any HOA that bans solar. Usually they're just silent on solar, and it's considered an architectural modification, so it goes in front of that committee, and then that committee denies it. So I'm not aware of any. So I'm not aware of anyone that's moved into an HOA to avoid solar, because I'm not aware of any HOA that's just banned it across the board.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, anything additional?
I mean, maybe this is something we can take and kind of see if there's something we can look into further to talk about this specific instance.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe House Research could answer that question. If in the scenario that I just laid out, would a homeowner that didn't want to live in a neighborhood with solar panels where it was said, where it was laid out in the bylaws that there's no rooftop solar, would they have any recourse against the Homeowners Association, or what would they do?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, so the general rule that's created at page 2, lines 11 to 15 of the bill, notwithstands any covenant restriction or condition contained in deed, security instrument, homeowners association document, or other instrument affecting the transfer, sale, or sale of real property. So it notwithstands any existing homeowners association documents. So there's really no recourse then, because the homeowners association that had previously prohibited solar just doesn't apply anymore.
Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
All right, not seeing any further discussion, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, final comments on your bill.
Thank you for the great question. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come before you today. Again, this just really allows homeowners to be able to take part in our climate change and our rapidly changing environment and marketplace. I know it's done wonders for my household, and it's been really frustrating to hear neighbors talk about how they really just want an intrinsic value as well as value in their pocket to be able to contribute to addressing climate change by putting solar on their roof, and to be told no with no reason from their HOA is just really frustrating for them. So thank you again for the time. Appreciate it.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 1262, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Last bill on the agenda today, Representative Norris. I will move House File 1181. In front of the committee today, and then I see you have an A1 amendment. Looks like it's a little bit more than just changing a word. So if you could tell us about the A1 amendment, Representative Norris.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Beckerfin. Just briefly, the A1 amendment is the result of some discussions between the Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Association for Justice. Both are in support of the bill, and if we adopt the A1 amendment, I know of no opposition to this bill.
Great. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Norris, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you. Chair Beckerfin and members, it's great to be with you here in the Judiciary Committee. House File 1181 helps to deal with those many times following an adverse event or a bad outcome at a healthcare facility where providers and patients kind of clam up in anticipation of a lawsuit. This bill provides a voluntary alternative to filing a lawsuit following an adverse event at a hospital or clinic. The process is only in cases where both parties agree to participate. The process, referred to as CANDR, which stands for Communication and Optimal Resolution, was first developed by the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. It's intended to incentivize open, honest, and direct conversations following an adverse event. The bill protects discussions between the provider and the injured party from potential discovery in a later lawsuit. This protection is offered only if both sides agree to enter the CANDR process, and allows either party to end the process at any point to pursue other legal actions. This process already exists in a handful of other states like Iowa, Colorado, and Utah. In those states, resolution has been much faster than litigation, think months instead of years, and rarely has an injured party chosen to pursue litigation once they've started the candor process. This does not preclude an injured party from filing a complaint with the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice or a facility from conducting an investigation. And with that, Chair Becker-Finn, I have a couple of testifiers for the bill.
All right. I have Dr. Will Nicholson and then Joel Carlson on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee. My name is Will Nicholson. I'm a family physician. I practice hospital medicine in the East Metro, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm testifying on behalf of the MMA, and it's more than 10,000 members in strong support of HF 1181. I want to take a moment to recognize the important work that healthcare workers do on behalf of patients in Minnesota. It has been a tough couple of years. Physicians, nurses, and everyone I work with in my day-to-day life care deeply about our patients, and we are devastated when a bad outcome or adverse event happens. And I'm going to use the term bad outcome because that's the one the patients seem to understand best. And although they're exceedingly rare, I'm here today to talk about bad outcomes in healthcare because there's more that we can do to prevent them. The legislation we're looking at today is first and foremost legislation about patient safety. For everything we do in medicine, there's a small risk of a bad outcome. And when something like that happens, patients want to understand what led to that outcome. And healthcare providers want to talk to them about it. It's one of the most effective ways to immediately limit the harm and prevent future bad outcomes from happening. Open, respectful communication maintains trust and supports safe culture in all professions, and especially in medicine. It's what physicians are taught to do in medical school as the gold standard. However, in our current environment, healthcare providers are often instructed by attorneys not to say anything to a patient for fear of litigation. As a result, a patient or their family may never hear from their healthcare provider exactly what went wrong. Now, this is appalling to most of us. This is a legal prescription for silence, and it can be devastating both to families and to providers. I personally know a talented physician who left practice because of a bad outcome that was treated in this way. It was incredibly demoralizing for him, and he never recovered from it. This bill will allow providers and patients to engage in open and honest discussions following a bad outcome by protecting these open conversations from potential discovery for possible litigation. By allowing healthcare providers and patients to be more open with each other, we can all better understand what happened, and we can better improve our processes and therapies as we go forward. This also allows for both patients and providers to receive support much sooner following a bad outcome than they would receive if they were unable to have a transparent conversation. HF 1181 is needed to create and protect the space where healthcare providers and their patients can participate in important open discussions without fear of those discussions being used against them if a lawsuit is initiated in the future. No healthcare provider ever wants harm to come to their patient, ever. We work every day to provide the best possible care for every patient, and HF 1181 will help us achieve that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important subject, and on behalf of the state's physicians, I urge you to support this. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Joel Carlson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and it's been about a little over a year that the MMA and MAJ have been working on this bill, and I think the MMA was surprised when I took their phone call because we wanted to work on this. I had been to a seminar that went through the candor process and how it can benefit patients. So we readily agreed to participate in this, and we've had an active partnership in bringing this bill forward because there are some instances where patients do want to know what happened. They're not interested in litigation. They just want to know what happened. And we appreciate the fact that having a healthcare provider tell you what happened can be a statement against interests. And so we appreciate and recognize that. I want to talk briefly just to the A1 amendment, because that's where some of the consumer protections are in the bill that as we've talked to practitioners across the country in Oregon and Colorado, Iowa and Massachusetts. I didn't catch anybody in Utah, and I didn't know they had approved it. But the first provision in the amendment really allows us to go both ways. A patient can ask for this process. Some states don't allow that. It is only doctor initiated. And so that first part of the amendment allows the patient to commence this process. The healthcare provider doesn't have to participate, but in some states it's just a one-way process. It's something that provider can offer you. This now goes both ways. We think that's an important protection, and it allows the patient to help direct their own care and finding out about their own care. We also want a patient, when they get to a point of maybe they're going to offer compensation because there was an adverse event that caused harm that is compensable. We want to make sure that they get legal counsel at that point and encourage them to get legal counsel, because there are a number of things about a settlement that a consumer won't know about, like do I have to pay the state back for medical assistance? And so we want advice at that point if they're going to resolve a claim through compensation. I think one of the biggest things that we agreed to in this bill, or we got an agreement on, is the bottom part of the amendment. This is what I call the trust but verify provision of the amendment. We want this to be honest and we want it to be open, but if they don't resolve it and the patient still wants to pursue their legal remedies, we want the same story to be told when it gets to litigation. So this section says if you say something different in a subsequent proceeding that is different than what you told the patient, you have a process to go to court and impeach that testimony because they didn't really tell you what, or you don't feel they told you what was the right thing. So I call that the trust but verify section, and I think that really helps move the ball forward. And to further that, we also added a sunset to this law. So if it doesn't work, if consumers don't use it, if we find out there are problems, we're going to have a chance to come back to the legislature. Maybe not when I'm here, but we're going to have a chance to come back to the legislature to address it. So with those changes, Madam Chair and members, we support this legislation, and we look forward to seeing it in implementation. We'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris. I along with Representative Carroll, are co-authors on this, and I'm happy to support it. I've had a lot of experience in civil litigation, not in medical malpractice litigation in particular, but I think that this bill does some important things in terms of providing and making sure that the remedies that are available are still available to people who are injured, but that those remedies are calibrated and balanced in a way that can cut through some of the problems that we sometimes see in litigation. Litigation can be important. It's important that injured people do have remedies through litigation, but it can be too slow and too expensive sometimes for everyone involved in the litigation. And so I appreciate that we're sort of learning some lessons about medical malpractice litigation in particular, and applying those in Minnesota, hopefully in a process that's going to work for everyone. So I appreciate the stakeholders on both sides of this coming together and really trying to be very practical. And I hope that we can take those lessons into every area where we're looking at civil litigation, creating private rights of action, making sure that they're balanced and calibrated in an appropriate way. And that's been the spirit of a lot of my discussions in this committee. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I'm happy to support it.
Closing comments, Representative Norris.
Thanks, Chair Becker-Finn, and it is a real privilege to be able to carry this bill. I'm appreciative of my bipartisan co-authors, Representative Carroll and Representative Niska, who are here on the committee, and want to thank all the stakeholders, too, who, as you heard, worked really hard over an extended period of time to come up with a solution that I think is going to be a real win for Minnesota patients. And like I said, it's just a real privilege to be able to carry this bill and help deliver that for Minnesotans.
All right. I'm not sure if I said at the beginning, but the motion, my motion is to recommend that House File 1181 be placed on the general register. So I would renew my motion now to recommend that House File 1181 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Norris. Got a big, busy day on Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.